As we saw at the end of the last programme, the Beach Boys had begun by the middle of 1963 to become more firmly established and were obviously not just another group to be thrown up by the latest craze. They had a lasting quality. Al Khoury, National Promotion Director for Capitol Records.
Once we got the first couple of hits out of the way, they became a very important rock group, you know. Even way back then, when we were going from record to record with them, they were recognized by some of the important radio people and even some of the more important young critics in those days. They were always accepted as being an exceptionally excellent vocal group, and they always came up with good records.
They started off with surfing, and then, of course, and Be True to Your School. I mean, you could have been a scholar and loved Be True to Your School. You didn't have to be a surfer or a greaser. You could have just been a whatever was in between. Yeah. The kids that really took no sides, that were just sort of there.
When some loud bragger tries to put me down.
Well, we've already heard on a couple of occasions of Brian's reluctance to appear at the concerts. So what effect did this have on the rest of them? Al Jardine.
Well, it affected his father very intensely. His dad was really uptight about it. Felt that he was copping out or felt that he was dodging responsibilities and gave him a pretty rough time. So I think that affected the group. Mm. Yeah, because we felt the repercussions from that because he was still our manager at the time. Right. So it was a little confusing, actually.
But Brian was adamant. Carl Wilson.
He just said, I don't want to tour. I want to stay home. And I want to make up music. And I remember my dad was upset about that. He thought it wasn't fair for him not to go and play for the people because they bought the records and they wanted to see him and so on. So anyway, he just wouldn't do it because he wanted to write. And then Alan came in the group to take Brian's place. And then when David Marks left the group, then Brian came back in. And then Brian stayed until the end of the year, and I remember it was in Houston. And then he just really got upset and he just had to leave. He was like, I think that's one of what people call as nervous breakdowns, but it wasn't really. It was just, he was just holding it in and it just came out. Just said, no, I can't do it, you know, and I'm stopping and that was it. It was a thing where it hurt his ears, you know, because he can only hear in his left ear, so. I think all the high sound pressure level, you know, is just too much.
And Marilyn Wilson agrees that the ear trouble was certainly one of the reasons Brian stopped touring.
On stage, it's just too painful for him. It really hurts him, and they play a lot on stage. And that was one factor, which really came later. I think the main reason at the beginning was because he couldn't write and tour at the same time. Touring, it's a hectic life. It's really hard. And Brian, that's not his makeup. He had to be home, and he had to write and get all the vibrations from everywhere in order to, you know, do his thing. So I think that's what mainly did it. And we just got married, which also helped. You know?
Did he miss being on stage with the band?
Yeah, I think he did. I really do. Because he didn't miss it as much as he loved staying home.
So now, with Brian out of the touring band more or less permanently, a replacement voice was needed. Various people were tried, including Delaney Bramlett, but eventually it was Glenn Campbell who was brought in.
I was with him for 6 months. I took Brian's place, sang the high part, and I played bass in the group. That was a lot of fun.
But how did they come across him? Al Jardine explains.
He used to record on a lot of our records. Mm. He used to play guitar, backup guitar. I don't think he played lead. He just did a lot of guitar work on a lot of the things that we did. And we knew he could sing. I don't know how, but I remember hearing it coming up. Hey, what about Glenn? And I said, yeah, he can sing. I think he can sing high as well. And I know he can play guitar because he did a lot of our sessions. He looked nice. He was a nice-looking guy. And just seemed to fit in for that period of time.
So why did he leave after 6 months?
I'm probably too much of an individual to... I was with the Champs for a while, and I enjoyed it at the time, but I didn't really like being responsible for something that a group did. And that's the way I felt when I was with the Beach Boys. If the Beach Boys did something, then I did it, and I didn't like that at all. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and that was a goal that I shot for, really.
Meanwhile, Brian had a little more time and freedom to concentrate solely on the music and to consider whether it might be a time for a slight change in direction. Mike Love.
I think the lyrics in I Get Around are kind of express or implied, stating that I'm getting bugged driving up and down the same old strip. I've got to find a new place where the kids are hip, meaning increased awareness, broadened awareness. I mean, we've done this before. We said surfing and this and that, and we were so aware that too many people took the group and its image for its surface value alone, you know, California and all this and that, and not enough people, it seemed, could hear the harmonies or the arrangements that went into them. Yet there were plenty of people who when they delved deep into the music, found that God, there's a heck of a lot there, you know, and there's a lot of harmony. And that was our initial love, was to get together and just harmonize. Brian is so overwhelmingly musical, and you defer to his judgment, you know. Often you add in an idea here for a structure there. Like, for instance, in I Get Around, it used to start like a slow ballad approach. I get around. I said, wait a second. Why don't we start, like, you know, right on top of it, like on Bob Brown. It goes, bop, bop, bop. Why don't we do it like, round, round, get around, I get around. And so that, it changed from the ballad approach to that approach. Although I'm sure the other approach would have been beautiful, you know. But we all just kind of gave our ideas, you know, on arrangements. But Brian really was the musical. Of course, everybody knows that. Mastermind of the whole thing. Round, round, get around, I get
around, yeah. Ah, that's great. That was I Get Around. And in fact, that proved to be the first Beach Boys number one record in America. And also their first big hit in Great Britain. This prompted a visit to Britain by the group, and we'll be hearing about that in a few moments. Although I Get Around was the first number one for the Beach Boys, it was not the first number one in which Brian Wilson had been involved. Exactly a year before, Surf City had been at the top of the charts by Jan and Dean. Dean Torrance tells how their relationship with Brian and the Beach Boys originally came about.
The working relationship with Brian started very accidentally, in that we knew that sometime or another we were going to have to work with them on the same show, and it ultimately happened. And some little record hop down in their area, which was Hawthorne. So there was just the two of us on this particular show. They, being a self-contained band, and we were not, the only way that they could do the show was to back us up. I mean, they could do their own set, and then they would have to stay on and back us. So consequently, we all got together a couple hours before the show and rehearsed our repertoire, which was maybe three songs, which were probably a song that was 4 or 5 years old at that time called Baby Talk, and another song, Heart and Soul, which was a few years after that. And we had a record that had just come out that was going to be a national hit called Linda. And then we probably had a couple of old traditional things that they could play, Louie Louie or whatever. Maybe four songs, four or five at the very most. In those days, that was a long show, half an hour. It was really a marathon. We kind of immediately all took to each other pretty well. They went on, did their set, then we came on and did our set. And the reaction to it was a reaction that was a little bit more intense than we had felt before. So after we had finished our set, they just didn't want us to go. So we didn't know any more songs. So we asked the Beach Boys if they wanted to do their set over again, sing Surfin' and Surfin' Safari, since we knew how to sing those. And I think that's where the breakthrough really happened, in that they saw that we were perfectly willing to do their songs. And that just usually wasn't done. You never acknowledged the other person. It was really fun, and we really had fun doing not our same old usual songs that we were tired of, and adding two vocal parts into their sets were really interesting. And driving home after that, we discussed doing those songs. We said, those are so much fun. We were about ready to go in the studio and record an album, which would be a follow-up to the single Linda. And we said, let's, on the Linda album, let's do some surfing songs and see how it works. Because it was really fun. And it was really fun putting those male voices in harmonies. We're used to putting girls and or just instruments doing harmony parts. Consequently, when we got in the studio, we had a small budget to work with, so we called Brian and said, look, we want to do Surfing and Surfing Safari on our new album. And he was thrilled. So we said, well, it's just one catch. Can you play the tracks for us? Can you get the guys up and cut the tracks? Because we're really short on money, and it's going to be tight budget-wise. And he was thrilled with doing that, too. So all the guys came into the studio and played the basic tracks to Surfing and Surfing Safari. And then we said, well, while you're here, we may as well do the vocal parts. And so we did all the vocal parts together, adding our parts in, which gave them more bottom and more top. You know, long story short, it just went from there. And in that particular session, Brian gave us Surf City.
And so, with the increased time Brian had now at his disposal, he was able to collaborate with Jan and Dean on more big hit records, like Drag City. Jan and Dean, and as well as Drag City, there were snatches there from Dead Man's Curve, Little Old Lady from Pasadena, and the one that sounds so much like Catch a Wave, Sidewalk Surfing. Now, I said a few minutes ago that the success of I Get Around prompted a visit to Great Britain by the group, and this was one tour that Brian didn't want to miss. Amongst their many fans in England was Tony Rivers of Tony Rivers and the Castaways, and he can remember the first time he heard one of their records.
At the time, we were just a semi-professional group, you know, just interested in harmony, but without ever having heard any real American acts, which really got a modern sound with harmony and electric guitars. And I suddenly heard one down the radio, Fun, Fun, Fun. And, you know, what? That sounds pretty lethal. And I just went out and bought the record. Then I realised it was on an album. Shut Down Volume 2. There never was a Volume 1, because I searched high and low for that. And after hearing that album, I was hooked completely.
Now then, just before we go any further, let's clear up the mystery about Shut Down Volume 1. Now, there was an album titled Just Shut Down, but only two tracks on it were by the Beach Boys. There was the title track and 409, and then numbers like Brontosaurus Stomp by the Piltdown Men, Four on the Floor, Wide Track, and Street Machine by the Superstocks, Hot Rod Race by Jimmy Dolan, and even a number by Robert Mitchum called The Ballad of Thunder Road. Anyway, back to Tony Rivers.
Then I read that EMI were bringing him over. So I immediately found out all the details, because I was with EMI at the time. We went to EMI and we met Carl. We had something about they had problems with their equipment, so we offered to lend them our van. You know, big exciting moment for us. You know, the magical Beach Boys were here, and we offered to take their guitars back to the Hilton, I think it was. It was myself and our drummer and our roadie, a Motley Crue, have you heard of one? And Carl Wilson. And I believe it was Dennis. We drove down Oxford Street and Carl was saying, oh, yeah, I love your cute little buildings. And we thought, well, you know, we never thought anything of Oxford Street. It's just Oxford Street, you know. But they were so knocked out with it, all the history and all this rubbish, you know. We went back to the hotel and we went out for a meal afterwards, and was the big American Carl paid the bill. And we was all most excited by it all. And we found out from, we saw their itinerary, they showed us it. And they were doing a BBC broadcast, which was the funniest thing ever. I mean, we went down to the Playhouse Theatre on the Embankment, and it was Bernie Andrews producing his session. And we thought, great, we're going to actually, because we'd been dying to hear them play. We'd only heard the records, and we wanted to hear them play and sing. And so there they were on the stage at the Playhouse Theatre. First time we'd ever seen this, because there were five of them singing, they all stood around the one microphone, and Al Jardine's only about, probably about 5'3" or something, like something silly, and he was standing on a chair at the back of them all. You know, this made us laugh to start with, but they couldn't really, for want of a better phrase, get it together. You know, they were trying, and they were, you know how it is on recordings, and when you can't quite get something, you all look at each other and you end up, someone giggles and then someone makes a rude noise or, and in the end they were all in stitches on the floor. They just couldn't get going, you know. They were, in all groups you get someone who's trying to get the thing going and there's someone who doesn't want to do it. He just wants to mess about and go, yeah. And that was Dennis, you know. He was really going, acting silly, and they really sounded quite childish, especially from the producer's point of view, because if ever you're a producer, someone, and in the studio they're going all, you don't get the point of the joke. You're just sitting there waiting to press your little button and record it. And this must have gone on for, I can't really say, but it's at least 20 minutes, I think, and they were just laughing. And Bernie Andrews was kept saying over the intercom, are we ready then, fellas, you know, in a, trying to retain some sort of British decorum. And the Beach Boys were collapsing about in laughter. And we were all in fits, because it's quite infectious when you're in there. And then suddenly Bernie Andrews comes storming out, right down the aisle at the front there. He gives them a right, which for me was really surprising, because I thought, all these big stars, he won't say anything. But he did. He came out and he gave them a right going at, you know. And then Dennis suddenly changed his mood. He suddenly became the big tough guy. And Dennis said, look, man, we've been... He went on to say they've been touring all around Europe and are shattered at the moment, and they don't take that sort of talk from anybody. And we went, you know, sort of pretending we weren't there. And anyway, they finally got it together. When they did it, which is the reason I brought this point up in the first place, when they finally got down to it, it sort of knocked us back in our seats. We were really staggered. We couldn't believe that there was anything to use guitar, bass and drums, you know, just really basic playing. But all these great voice parts, you know, all these different... I mean, Carl wasn't playing all these chords on guitar. He was playing basic chords, really. But they were singing these beautiful chords across it. We thought, wow, this is tremendous, you know. And Brian Wilson sort of noticed that we were jigging about in our seats. And at the end of the number, when the red light had gone off, we all clapped, you know. We really were so knocked out with it. A few minutes later, you know, there was a lull between recordings. And Brian Wilson actually came over to us. It sounds like God worship, which it isn't, but... At the time, we were a bit starry-eyed, you know. He came over to us, and for the first time that week, he spoke, and because up to then, I thought he was a really moody sort of person. He came over and he said, did you like that? We said, sure, we'd never heard anything from a modern group to touch that, you know. And he, from that moment on, he was full of talk. He was raving about the Four Freshmen and asking us about how we sung. It was just that one link between... Some people you don't get on with, other people you do, but he may have been one of those people who had to find something mutual that you both liked. But as soon as he knew that we liked that, he was full of chat, and the whole atmosphere was different, and I think even Bernie Andrews was happy.
Well, I'm sure you'll have noticed that we just played the record of When I Grow Up, although the group did record that number on the session Tony was talking about. Unfortunately, the original tapes have now been destroyed, so if you're listening now and you recorded that session, which was broadcast on one of the original Top Gear programmes on the Old Light programme, October the 19th, 1964 was when it was broadcast, we'd certainly like to hear from you. The visit to England was part of a 24-day trip to Europe, which included a concert at the Olympia in Paris, radio and TV appearances in Berlin, Frankfurt, Munich and Rome, another concert in Stockholm, and a visit to Copenhagen. A good chance for all the group to soak up some European culture, particularly Mike Love.
It was late at night. Everybody's asleep in Britain, but we can't sleep. So we go out to trying to find some place to eat, and that's not working out too well. So we went out to this real late night spot, and they had some fried potatoes, you know, and something to eat. So Alan and I were sitting down eating, minding our own business, and there's this girl that comes up to us and sits down. Haven't I seen you fellas before? We said, well, of course, we hope that she has, because we're thinking, you know, this is our first trip to England. Gee, I hope somebody's promoting us. Maybe she has seen us before, or is she just trying to come on, you know, because she definitely wasn't selling newspapers, I'll tell you. So we were sitting there, and she's talking to us. She's a real nice girl, so we're talking to her. And we're eating and everything. It was all enjoyable. And then she says, I know you guys from somewhere. I said, oh, come on, how do you know? You know, and she said, I don't know, I just have the feeling I do. So she said, can I come and dance for you? And we said, what? You know? So she wants to come and dance for us. So we got in a cab, but the mind-blowing thing that happened is on the way over to the hotel in the cab, we copped out and we told her what we did for a living, right? We're in a singing group. She says, that's where I saw you. I have this little EMI postcard-sized picture of you fellows, you know? And the thing that got me even worse is that she says, what kind of music do you like? And we said, oh, this and this and this. And she says, I love the Four Freshmen. And we almost fell out of the cab. She loves the Four Freshmen. So we end up driving back to London Hilton with this young lady. She's singing the melody for the Hearts Were Full of Spring, and Al and I were singing the harmony, and we're singing the Hearts Were Full of Spring going back to the... That killed me. We're wide awake anyway, so she comes up to our suite, you know. We're sharing a room, sharing a suite in the London Hilton. We come in there, and she's, oh, pretty nice, you know. And so she wants to dance for us, so she turns on BBC. And she starts dancing around and everything. It's amazing.
Dance, Dance, Dance was the next single release when the Beach Boys got back to California after their European tour. But the other song on the single was also good, and one that Mike Love had written with Brian a year previously.
In the warmth of the sun, Brian and I wrote the night before President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And it was pretty weird because I can remember feeling very, moody, very eerie feeling, a haunting feeling about this particular song. And if you play that song, that it's very haunting. I think you'll agree. It's kind of wistful and whatever adjectives you can use to describe it. But anyway, we wrote it about losing someone that was close. I had someone in mind that I had been very much in love with, and then it just didn't work out, you know. And still I have the warmth of the sun, meaning the warmth of that memory within. So we wrote that till about 3 a.m, and then we crashed, you know, went to sleep, and the next thing we heard was a radio announcement, you know, of Kennedy being shot.
That particular song was one of the favourites of Murray Wilson, the Beach Boys' manager, and it's his relationship with them that we now take a look at. Without doubt, he did work very hard for the group, Audrey Wilson, his wife.
I think he did about 7 jobs that would now, today, take 7 different men. And it was without experience, except just a native intelligence and just a tremendous pride and loved his sons, you know, a lot. Mm. And just wanted them always to be better, always to be stronger, always be honest. Thank God they heard that enough. They had so much trouble with producing in the beginning, because Brian really was doing the producing, but there was a producer at Capitol who claimed that, you know, he wanted his little claim to fame. And the boys wanted to record in another studio other than Capitol. And I remember Murray argued with the vice president of Capitol for 5 straight months. And they would argue. I could sit across the room and hear Will Gilmore, right? I could hear his voice. Just Murray and he would just be screaming at each other. But Murray got his way.
The subject of that dispute between Murray and Foyle Gilmore was, of course, producer Nick Vernay. And so perhaps that ought to be borne in mind as he recounts the difficulties that arose between the group and Murray, even in the early days.
First off, everyone in the company agreed, including myself, everyone agreed that Brian, without a doubt, was becoming, and I hate to use the word genius, because it's not fair to tag that on anyone, but he was a bright talent who had just scratched the surface of making records. And the father, who has passed away, so that makes it even more difficult. So I'm just going to state things I know about him. I thought he was boxing Brian in. And then the man would come up with his own melodies. He was competing with Brian also. He would write songs on the piano, melodies, and have people write lyrics to them. And they were really kind of syrupy old pop songs type things. And I think that this was the beginning split there. I think that Brian started to realize, whether it was conscious or subconscious, that the father was, in a sense, a competitor. I know you shouldn't fear competition, but had he not been related, I think he could have done whatever he wanted to do, such as show his own songs, that kind of thing. I think it would have worked out. But again, because he was blood related, it became a family competition. And I could see it driving things apart. One instance in the studio, they asked me to make sure he wasn't at the studio. And I agreed I would ask him not to come by the studio that night. Then he called me and told me that they had just patched up their argument and he'd like to come by. Of course, I was thinking again on the family level that he is related to them. It was wonderful they patched up their argument. I said, well, then, indeed, please do come by the studio. Unknown to me, they hadn't patched up. And it's just another family, as only a family can argue. I can say things to my brother that if anybody else said it to him, I'd have to punch them in the mouth. And there he was at the session, and I'm in the middle, and they were at the session, and it just an entire family argument ensued. And no matter what I did, I was wrong. If I picked a side, I was wrong. You can't. And I could see it slowly falling apart, and I could see Brian, all this bright talent, all this energy, getting boxed in because of a family tie.
But whatever the disputes, Murray's enthusiasm for the group never waned.
He loved music and he loved, you know, us. And it was his everything. I mean, he was into it. You know, he let it all out.
Was he a strict disciplinarian with the band in the early days, didn't he?
Yeah, kind of, you know. But not really. I mean, he, you know. But down deep, he was a joker, you know. He just would wail, you know.
He got more into it than any. I don't know anybody who could get down more, you know, and into it more than my dad. I mean, he got into it so far, I mean, it would frighten us sometimes. He helped us learn how to make records, really, because he would listen to the vocals and, you know, and talk to us and hype us and, you know, and do all sorts of stuff to get us to sing better and to punch when we were tired or something, you know. And like to see him in the room, you know, through the window when you're singing, like, it's a freak out sometimes. Because he just
would. Booze, what about the shows?
Yeah.
We do shows, and we know how you want to look pretty cool on stage. We were 17 and being cool. There's my dad, runs down the center of the show going, Treble! You know, going like this, and everyone's looking at him, you know. Okay. He's amazing. Nothing to stop.
Dennis Wilson with a few words off mic from Carl. Yet despite his enthusiasm, Murray and the group finally discontinued their managerial relationship. Audrey Wilson again.
The boys just really weren't happy. They really weren't. And I think at that time they were going through, you know, really growing pains, and they had grown so fast. And they thought they really knew more than they did. They've said so since. And Murray wasn't happy either. He was miserable most of the time. So it was just seemed a natural thing.
And Carl Wilson.
It was just too much tension in the family. I think it was difficult separating the family thing from the group thing. And, you know, he was having to function in a couple different ways. He was great for us, he really was. And after, he was not our manager anymore. He still always helped the group in a lot.
So Murray was no longer the group's manager, although he did stay on to run the publishing company for Brian's songs called Sea of Tunes. But if some people are equivocal in their feelings towards Murray, the group's friend and advisor, Fred Vail, is certainly not.
I don't have enough words of praise to say for the man, really. If I was in show business as a performer, there's only one person that I've ever met in my life that I would have manage me, and that's Murray Wilson. When Murray wanted something, he'd go right to the top. He would camp outside of the president of Capitol Records for hours, if necessary, to see the man if he felt the Beach Boys needed something. Maybe it was new publicity pictures. Maybe it was a page ad in Billboard. Maybe it was the fact that the last photo session hadn't turned out well. He knew there was an album coming up, and he wanted to make sure that the graphics for the album were top-notch and not mediocre. He was just the type of guy that wanted so much for them that he gave up a lot of himself. Murray was a gentleman in a business that unfortunately is not made up of a lot of gentlemen. There are a lot of very, very successful business people in entertainment. I wish all of them had the humility and pride and love and concern and honesty of a Murray Wilson. Unfortunately, that isn't the case. And unfortunately, as a result, many groups and many artists who achieve major success look back 10 years later and say to themselves, well, where in the hell did it all go?